everyone. Welcome back to Historical Friction, a podcast about retelling the past and reframing the present through pop culture and fiction. I'm Alice, and for today's episode, I'm joined by Abigail, Helen, and Sarah to discuss the 1965 film A Study in Terror. This is actually part of our Ripper Watch series. The movie is a Jack the Ripper adaptation featuring Sherlock Holmes. It's strange. All of your usual content warnings apply for our Ripper Watch series. We're discussing the Whitechapel murders and the representation in pop culture of the deaths of five women. It's a bit different than normal because this is clearly a 1960s comedy, but the standard kind of discussion of murder, discussion of sex work applies to this episode. Little note to say that we recorded this one at the same time as next week's episode about Enola Holmes. We weren't sure which one we were going to release first, so there are a few references in this episode to Enola Holmes. They come as a pair. Those references will make sense next week when you can hear the Enola episode. In the meantime, I'm sorry if you haven't seen that film and you don't understand what we're talking about. As always, you can find us on Twitter at History Friction, and the podcast is on Patreon at Historical Friction. All of the support that you give us there helps us to continue to make these episodes and improve them in every way. We've started doing little monthly digests for our patron supporters. You can read the April one. It's out now. It's just what we've been reading, watching, what we're into, that sort of thing. Little teasers for upcoming episodes. We'll be putting out the one for May at the end of the month, so if you want to sign up now, you definitely won't miss that. We're very grateful to you for listening and helping us out. Enjoy the show! We're all back. We're doing another Ripper Watch. This time we watched A Study in Terror from 1965. This is a really weird film because it's a Ripper Watch, but it's also a Sherlock Holmes movie. So it dovetails quite nicely with Enola Holmes and also connects to our Ripper Watch series. Essentially, the plot of this film is that Sherlock Holmes is brought in to solve the Whitechapel murders. I say plot, this film sucked. I think we can all agree that this film sucked because it's shoehorning these kind of two very different narratives together and bringing a fictional character into these real life cases. To give it a very brief plot summary, Sherlock Holmes is enlisted by two different sources, and one of them is a mystery woman who he has not yet identified. The other is his brother and also the Prime Minister, who I think is meant to be Disraeli? It's a bit weird. He finds a surgeon's case, realizes it must be connected to the Whitechapel murders, spends a lot of time hanging out in a soup kitchen, which is also attached to a morgue. We're going to talk about that. This is a very weird film. Essentially, the conclusion of this is that a duke's son, who was a doctor called Michael, married a woman who was a sex worker. Her name is Angela. Angela cheats on him with a man whose name I cannot remember, but I think he's
Max.
Max.
Max is the best character.
Yeah, Max
is
Snyder,
a big blonde German.
I'm laying the line down. Max is the best character in A Study in Terror.
Oh, no, no, I'm 100% in life. Your corner here. Like, he doesn't have a lot of lines, but he, like, actually has... He, like, really redeems himself by staying with his horribly disfigured girlfriend through the entire thing, like...
Wife Angela has an affair with Big Jam and Max. The two of them conspire to blackmail Dr. Michael's younger brother.
They conspired to blackmail Michael, but then Carfax found out about it.
Yes.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yep. Yep.
Thank
yeah,
you.
Yeah. So, like, okay. Yeah, there's, they say, it's unclear exactly what happened, but apparently the wife and Max went to Michael and said, we're going to blackmail you. And, like, I think it succeeded for a little while, but then they had this big, like, fight whereby one version of the story is that Angela or Angeline, I don't remember, but she grabs, like, a bottle of acid and is going to throw it on Michael, but her arm gets jostled and it goes in her face instead. And so her whole beautiful angel-like face becomes disfigured by the acid. And then Michael gets, like, hit really hard and essentially, like, loses brain function to the point that he can no longer be a doctor and doesn't really remember who he is or anything about himself. And then the other version that we hear from her later is that Michael was actually a really horrible, abusive husband, and that he purposefully threw the acid on her face during that same fight. And it's unclear which one is accurate, but at any rate...
I was very preoccupied by Twitter during, like, this part of the film, and that is saying something about how gripping this film was. But I was under the impression Michael and Angela blackmail together, blackmail the brother. And then it's Angela and a big German Max. When they leave him, they confronted. Because that's why both the brothers go, quote unquote, insane. Oh. And like why Max then buys a bar with the money that Carfax gives him.
Right.
Look, this should have been so much clearer.
Right. It was, yeah.
Like, the fact that the four of us cannot figure out what the plot of this film was says quite a lot. Anyway, the younger brother is Jack the Ripper because he has never met Angela and he's so angry at this sex worker for ruining his brother's life that he's going to murder everyone that he comes across on the off chance that it ends up being her. So the kind of the plot of this film is that these women are to blame for two men absolutely fucking losing their minds. Everything about this film sucks.
Yeah, what like astonished me most about the conclusion was that it wasn't like he, because usually you get sort of the like pseudo psychoanalytic take that like Jack the Ripper is a misogynist and hates women, or like in some versions, what's the one that we watched or read where it was like he was trying to get revenge for syphilis that a prostitute had given to like, oh, that was From Hell. Yeah. And so like it feels like there's like a vendetta against prostitutes as a whole kind of thing. This one literally made it out to be not that he was killing prostitutes as a vendetta, but that he literally was trying to find the one prostitute to kill. Like he was just gonna kill everybody because eventually it would be her, right? And I was like, wait, what?
But they do all this stuff as well to set it up that it's going to be the doctor who runs a soup kitchen slash mm-hmm. morgue, or like a woman, or the Dr. Murray's like assistant, because yeah, like they talk about deviancy a lot, and there's a scene where he like fondles the feet of a dead victim of Jack the Ripper. There are all these like bits of misdirection, like they're obviously intentional, but then what happens is that rather than making it believable or understandable that what had, like, that there's evidence for this, the final conclusion, all that is that Sherlock Holmes had noticed how quickly he put away the material in a surgical case in the beginning. That's the evidence.
Oh my God.
Yeah, the evidence was very flimsy. It really felt like mm-hmm. Sherlock's deductions were more like magic tricks throughout this thing rather than they tried to set it up scientifically, because early on in the film, they like cut to his quarters at Baker Street and he has like lab equipment and beakers and it's supposed to feel very scientific. They clearly want to align Sherlock with science and enlightenment and logic and deduction, which is what we do think of him as, I think, culturally now. But ultimately, he's like, literally, there's a scene where he shoots a gun inside his room at like a vase and it breaks. And Watson's like, oh, my vase, you broke my vase. And I was like, you're just casually going to shoot. Look, it goes through the wall. Like, what is wrong with you, Sherlock? There were just a lot of really off the wall moments like that.
Yeah, he uses his masterful powers of deduction and gives the classic, like, when you exclude all the probable things, the only thing, however improbable, must be the answer, to reveal that Watson is sitting on his pipe.
That was a really adorable moment, though, because it was like, oh, look at these two middle-aged gays having a domesticated moment in their matching smoking jackets. It's precious. Yeah.
The best thing about this film is that it really does go for the, like, life partners aspect of Holmes and Watson, which I did enjoy. That did bring me a lot of delight. They have often very nicely coordinating outfits, which is incredibly elder gay in just the most beautiful way.
They're super married, and Sherlock pretty much exclusively uses his many disguises to embarrass Watson in various social settings.
But can I give you an example of a deduction that he makes in this film? Watson is reading the paper and he says that a woman has been murdered in Whitechapel. And he goes, oh, yes. And then deduces that she was a prostitute. And Watson is like amazed at how could he possibly have known this? And his answer is, well, the paper was printed at like, it hadn't happened yesterday. The paper was printed at like 3 o'clock this morning. So it would have happened in the middle of the night. And no respectable woman is out in Whitechapel in the middle of the night. Therefore, she would have been a prostitute.
It was just such flawless ripperology, you know? It's like everything that Holly Reubenhold has been writing against, it is a very simplistic idea. And unfortunately, it's an idea that still, I think, has a lot of resonance when you hear about women who are murdered in the middle of the night. You're like, oh, well, they shouldn't have been outside, I guess. And that's upsetting.
Yeah.
Yeah. The way the murders in this are played for jokes is kind of weird.
Oh, boy.
I mean, I did straight up laugh at the first murder. So, yeah, before
it's very
the movie,
not to.
It is before the movie really gets going. Like the opening shots are like feet walking along the pavement, and there are these gorgeous red shoes, by the way, that
so
I would
cute.
Like to own. And
I want those shoes.
Yeah. And so you're watching these shoes walking down the street, and there's like some men's shoes, and then they stop, and the camera pans up the length of a woman who's wearing kind of a shabby dress with these beautiful red shoes, and gets to her face, and she says like, hello, mister, would you care for some fun? Or, you know, something like that. And, or like, hello, darling. And, then she screams and it like cuts, and then it shows her laying prone on the ground with a knife just through her neck that like Jack the Ripper didn't even bother to pull out. And it's like you can tell that they like glued half a knife on one side of her neck and like the other half of the knife on the, you can even like see the costuming glue that they used. It's ridiculous.
Very reminiscent of those comedy arrows where they go, yes. They go around the back.
Absolutely. And I just cracked up, and it did sort of so the funny. The thriller horror soundtrack of like wing wing wing, like, you know, and like, oh no, somebody's been dead, and like a landlady peers over and yells murder, and then it cuts to the opening credits, and all of a sudden the music is like we're in the Caribbean. It's like real beachy and chill, and it's like doo 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 da doo doo doo, and I was like, what just happened? I'm not even sure.
This film was absolutely fucking unhinged, and like by far the best thing about it is the styling. So this is a 60s does Victorian styling. It's a classic studio film. So they build all the sets, which is incredible, and gives this brilliantly like styled aesthetic that you do not get with kind of modern sound stages and CGI and things like that. And it gives such a specific atmosphere that you don't even get with location shooting, because it's all just so meticulously managed. And I love studio films of this type where you have like the whole set that they've built somewhere out in Ealing, and it's just it's really, really brilliant. Everyone has the very Oi Mister You Me Dad kind of aesthetic and voice and everything. And it's so funny. And it's got all the kind of like Technicolor styling of it as well. We all of us individually messaged our group chat to be like, did they just reuse the costumes from Oliver?
Yes.
So and, like, similar.
The film version of Oliver came out 3 years later, although they were almost certainly just borrowing the costumes from the stage version at this point. And it's got this really, like, incredibly campy look to it. And that's in the costumes and Holmes's disguises and things like that. But it's got a fucking Barbara Windsor cameo in it. Like, this film has such a like distinctive mood to it that even though it sucked, I kind of loved the very like schlocky styling.
I also love the way that you can tell that it was made in the 60s, because despite the fact that the women are all in pseudo-Victorian dresses, they all still have like very 60s hair. They have the beehives, and also like the like hair flip thing that you would wear like a thick headband with. It was so, their makeup was so 60s, everything about it.
I absolutely love those vibes. Like that time traveling 1960s girl goes to the Victorian period is like my jams, and I want to dress like that and make these costumes my whole personality. Not the content, just the costumes.
I actually texted my mom when I was watching it, and I was like, every woman in this film looks like she's in the 60s. And I was like, and I don't even know that it's just the makeup and styling. I was like, I think maybe everybody born in like the 1930s had a specific look because all these women look like grandma. Like, I was like, I can't, you know, like when she was young, obviously. But like, I was like, this is no, very
it's
strange.
So funny. The little rabbit hole that I went down is that there are a couple of scenes that take place in the pub owned by Big German Max. And the woman sings, she sings these kind of like music hall songs, and they spend a lot of time on her. And I was like, she must be someone important. Like, she's going to turn out to be one of the women. She's going to be like an accomplice or something like that. She's not. She's just there for the musical interludes in a very 60s way. It reminded me strongly of like the music hall scenes in Newsies or something like that, where they're like, we're just going to have a little saucy bit of skirt flashing fun to kind of break up the drama. And I was like listening to this and I was like, she has such a very distinctive way of singing. And it is the kind of like 60s does music hall styling. Her name's Georgia Brown. She was a friend of Lionel Bart and she originated the role of Nancy in Oliver. So he then wrote a couple of the songs specifically for her and her style, which is why, like, so she originates the role of Nancy. The whole kind of the writing of this character is designed around her, which is why then when you see her perform, even though she's not, you know, in that character and she's not the person who plays Nancy in the film version, it has such a, like, Lionel Bart vibe.
Because we were all saying that it's so redolent of Oliver the musical.
Exactly.
But you were like rightly pointing out that that couldn't have been the case because that film hadn't been released yet. So that's the origin story for why it is so Nancy-esque. That is amazing.
Yeah.
That is a genuinely fun fact.
So that was like, that was my fun fact. That was the rabbit hole that I went down while I was incredibly bored by this film.
Abigail pointed out something super interesting in the group chat as well. And that was the similarities between that scene and the similar scene in the, is it in like 1992? I don't know what it's called in English because in Swedish it's Mästerdetektiven in Basil Mus.
It's The Great Mouse Detective, which came out in 1986 and is a Disney film. That is based on a book series, actually, a children's book series called Basil of Baker Street, about a mouse who lives beneath Sherlock Holmes's house and solves cases like Sherlock Holmes. And Disney was originally going to call, sorry, this is a Disney tangent, but they were originally going to call the film Basil of Baker Street. And then Eisner came in and was like, that's never going to sell. We're calling it The Great Mouse Detective. And the animators were really angry. And they were like, okay, well, why don't we call Cinderella like Girl with Glass Shoe and things like that? Like just really obvious names for everything. But yeah, in Great Mouse Detective, there is a scene that's a saloon scene that is incredibly similar to the saloon that Max owns. And I was like, are saloon scenes just necessary in Sherlock films?
I think this must be a conscious like reference. Like it's 20 years later, but it's still like it's so similar. Like why is there even a musical interlude in this Jack the Ripper film?
Taking this as a cultural artifact much more from the 1960s than the 1880s, I think this is really representative of how in the 1960s, people were beginning to get reinterested in Victorian histories and Victorian aesthetics, because in the early part of the 20th century, everything Victorian was passé. And by the late 60s, this was kind of the point where it was beginning to go more on an upswing again. People were more interested in Victorian art. People were more interested in Victorian aesthetics. The values of these things were going up because kind of that 50 or 60 year window had passed and things that were completely passé were sort of coming back. And this was also the time in the late 1960s when they were doing quite a lot of slum clearing in London. So I think there's kind of this sense of like almost nostalgia for a world that has had all its roughest edges scrubbed off by being forgotten, which you also see in Oliver the Musical, which came out a little later, the film version, but it's very similar kind of vibes of like this kind of aestheticized suffering where it all gets turned quite jolly, quite amusing, quite music hall, and all the roughness of it is kind of scrubbed away and elided, which is really, really interesting as a cultural artifact. The problem is that it's dealing with a real story of real murders, which were brutal and horrible, and it's kind of trying to fit this, like, holly jolly, let's all have a sing-song aesthetic into this really dark story. And so the outcome is just sort of unintentionally surreal, I would say. Like, in the 60s, they were doing some fun surrealist Victorian stuff, but this is not that. This is just, like, the tone of this is bizarre.
Yeah, I thought, for me, what was interesting is how unsexualized the murders were. When Jack the Ripper murders these women, it literally, for like three of them, it's just they're like walking down the street and the camera's like behind them, and then it cuts and you like see a hand reaching towards them, and then they scream and it's all over. So it's not, it doesn't even show him like engaging. There's not even like a, you know, masked figure or whatever going, hey, and then being like, hey there. Like, it's just them walking down the street. They're not doing anything. There's no indication other than the fact that they're outside at night that they're even prostitutes, other than the first one who, you know, says, hello, darling. And the last one, which was hilarious, actually. It's not. But, like, for Mary Kelly, the way that they did that one, which was the only one that really was given any time, the camera suddenly goes point of view to Jack the Ripper. And it is looking up at Mary Kelly, who's leaning out the window of her rooms. And she kind of engages the camera in a conversation, but the camera never replies. So she's just like, hey, you there, you look like you're a gentleman that might want a good time. Do you want a good time? And the camera just kind of looks at her. It might even nod a little bit. And then she's like, okay, let me go get the key. I'll toss you down the key. And she throws down the key, and the camera, you see, looks down at the pavement, gets down. You see a hand pick up the key. The camera walks to the door. The hand opens the door with the key. She's standing at the top of the stairs. Camera looks up at the top of the stairs. She's like, come on up. Camera goes up the stairs into her bedroom. She starts talking about how she hasn't been out on the streets for like 2 months because of Jack the Ripper. And so she hasn't, you know, and then she says something about how she hasn't been doing this for long, which clearly they want you to think that this is like her attempt at seeming innocent or something, but that probably she has been doing this for a long time. It seemed like sort of a layered comment. She's undressing throughout this. She gets to just a corset and her shift, basically, and she gets on the bed and is trying to like writhe around sexily. The camera still hasn't said anything. And then he murders her. Or, like, there's a scream, basically, and it cuts away like it does for all the other murders. But what was hilarious to me about that is that in 2001, there was a Christopher Walken SNL skit called The Continental, which made the exact same use of camera POV that way. I did rewatch it after watching this film, and it's a little skeevy. It doesn't quite hold up. There's like, you know, some sexual harassment in it that they're kind of playing for a joke. But I'm pretty sure I saw that episode live when I was very little, and I thought it was the funniest thing ever. But yeah, it's the same thing. The camera like goes to this man's house, but it's a woman, and you see her gloved hand, and Christopher Walken's like, hello there, come on in, I'm the Continental. And he's like, do you want some champagne? And the camera like nods yes and no, and like he's trying to hit on her, and then she gets upset and ends up punching him, and then she runs for the door, and he's like, aha, I have the key, and he tries to eat the key, and then the camera runs back to him, and you see the hand punch him in the stomach and grab the key, and then you literally see the hand use the key to open the door to get out. And I was like, this was just The Continental, and it that was for me the best part of the film.
I think I actually, of the film, aesthetically at least, that was the part that I enjoyed the most. And it does feel kind of perverted saying that, because it is the most sort of sexualized and voyeuristic portrayal of a woman being killed. Somehow it is the most aesthetically coherent moment in the film, and that's saying something, because as we've said, there is this like weird hybridity of aesthetics that sort of doesn't make sense. For me, that scene is pure camp kitschy 1960s pornography. They've got this strange pink lighting that I think is intended to be sort of red and bloody, but it reads as this kind of erotic strip club aesthetic that is enhanced by these lamps that are covered with silk shawls, and you have this woman wearing winged eyeliner with beehive hair,
so
rolling around
so
in a corset, breasts akimbo, and right up until the violence, it's just campy and fun and very, very 60s. And aesthetically, the eye enjoys that. The brain is thinking this is a sick way to depict probably the most grisly of the Ripper's killings. But yeah, maybe I'm perverted for enjoying it as much as I did.
No, it's so highly styled. It's so high. It's like full on Vaseline lens softcore. And the kind of juxtaposition of that and the material is such a mindfuck. Like, the whole way through this film, I kept being like, they're going to burst into song any minute, because it feels like that is the kind of aesthetic that I associate, you know, with this. That is the kind of genre that I associate with this aesthetic. And then people keep getting stabbed, but it's this like bright orange blood, and the murder scenes are very like weirdly sort of stylized and barely shown. They're very undersexualized. There's a lot of like heavy censoring of the violence in this, and that's obviously, it's a 60s film, like, duh. But it feels, it's such a mindfuck watching this film and being like, this is a campy 60s studio piece on a Victorian set. They're gonna burst into song any second now. It's gonna be a little comedy lark about some chirpy little, you know, some plucky little hookers having a good time at the expense of the man. And you know, Barbara Windsor's in it, and she appears, and I'm like, well, this is gonna be a comedy, right? She's in her little red dress and her new bonnet, and she's playing Annie Chapman, and she's got that incredible squeaky voice, which I just love so much. Like, her whole aesthetic, her voice, everything about her as like a performer is so incredible and so appealing, and it's so camp. And I was watching it and I was like, surely this is a comedy. Like, surely the twist is that this is going to be like a pastiche of the kind of Ripper film, and it's going to be like full of jolly larks and rosy-cheeked orphans. And it's not. And it's just like, I'm so confused. I'm just so confused.
And the way, like, so obviously they can't show us how incredibly violent and how horrified people were and continue to be by these murders, except for in one scene, and that's when Dr. Watson and Lestrade leave, like, the murder scene of Mary Jane Kelly, and they're, like, white-faced and very, very, you know, like, this is the worst thing they've ever seen. And then turns out that Angela Osborne's, like, face, after having had acid poured on like a part of her cheek, elicits a stronger reaction from Watson than that did. Like, he sees her face and then like stands up in horror.
And it's the horror of her face that stops her being murdered by Carfax, because he hesitates in the moment of seeing her disfigured face, and that's the thing that saves her life.
Yeah, I thought Watson was my favorite character in this film. He made me laugh the most throughout it with his reactions. But yeah, I did think, yeah, the one where he sees her face after having just been at a murder scene, and he's like, oh God, the horror.
Throughout this entire film, John Watson functions as like an exposition vehicle. Like, it's whenever, you know, in the same scene, he once goes, oh, that was the day before. And then he interrupts himself so that he doesn't tell. And then, like, just a second later, he goes, like, oh, but that's the same woman. And then stops, just so that the audience doesn't have to, you know, remember any names or think about it. Like, he will just, like, tell you. At one scene, they're leaving the pawnbrokers where they've figured out, like, that they figured out where the surgical case came from. Watson goes, why are you rushing? He says, oh, to see Annie Chapman's body. And he's like, oh, do you mean the woman who was murdered yesterday? It's like, yeah, obviously. Yeah.
Speaking of names, though, they really don't give any names to the Ripper victims. if you didn't already know their names, I don't think that you would catch that they say them ever in this film. And I don't know that they ever do say Mary Jane Kelly's name. I'm not sure that that's used at all.
No, and it feels very much like they're using it like set dressing, or almost like an Easter egg, that because Annie Chapman talks about her new bonnet, mm-hmm. which is a thing that we'd know from, well, from Ripperology certainly, but also probably from the real life records, that was a thing that she would have talked about. Here is like, it's just this one, so if you are into it, you would hear about it or know it, but otherwise it's just like a piece of set dressing.
Which makes it all the more frustrating that they're using the Ripper story and the lives of the Ripper victims in this way. Because you could have created a Sherlock Holmes mystery that was exactly the same, and it wouldn't have needed to involve Whitechapel or these particular women at all. So they're really just kind of being used as props in a way to further this narrative and fulfill one guy's Sherlock Holmes fan.
Yeah, but do you know, like, who that guy was? Because I think this explains.
No, please tell us, because I was so confused by this.
It was produced by Sir Nigel Films, which was set up in, like, the 1960s to make movies from the Sherlock Holmes estate. This story is based on a short story written by Adrian Conan Doyle, Arthur Conan Doyle's fourth son. Like, let me tell you a little bit about his life, and then I think you can understand why this book, why this, like, this source material here is so incredibly lacking. Like, we have stories in the press about, like, in 1938, his python named Tycho disappeared and then, like, was found later in a Chelsea flat a few days later. In 1944, he served in the Navy for, like, just over a month and was discharged because he was unfit for naval service. In, like, 1944, like, anyway.
Famously not a time when the Navy was being fussy.
How bad do you have to be? In 46, him and his wife got, quote, bored of civilization, so they fled to live for 6 months on a 30-foot schooner to study tropical marine life in Zanzibar. Right, like, and then he wrote a bunch of biographies, or he helped write biographies about his dad. He then lived for a couple of years in Tangiers. He toured around with supervising a Sherlock Holmes exhibition. Yeah, in 62, him and Henry E. Lester start Sir Nigel Films. And then, like, he moved to Switzerland. In his obituary, he is named as a big game hunter, a fisherman, a zoologist, an explorer, an author. And he had a big collection of armory and old keys, as well as, like, his stuff that pertained to his father's estate.
Oh, God, he sounds boring as,
like,
fuck.
There's a very particular type of English, like, fail son that also then produces the source material for this film.
Suddenly the themes within this film of brothers being the black sheep of the family and being disowned and going insane about it are making a lot of sense.
And you know what also makes sense? The fact that as soon as Sherlock Holmes shows up with the now incapacitated oldest son, who the father has been yelling about, like, no, I will disown him, I never want anything to do with him again, as soon as Sherlock Holmes is like, he suffered for his sins, the father immediately flips and is like crying and says, take him up to his old room, thank you so much, I love my son again. This is just like large adult son fanfic.
But I think it's really interesting in light of what we talked about in the previous episode with Enola Holmes and how they were sued by the Sherlock Holmes estate for wanting to portray Sherlock with emotions. And here, I mean, obviously there is like a big time gap in between, that there's not the same people in charge, but I think it's still kind of telling that this is the official, like, sanctioned continuation of the Sherlock Holmes narrative in the 1960s, and it is trash.
It continues to prove that people other than Arthur Conan Doyle shouldn't really be writing Sherlock Holmes, because they're not very good at it, and their deductions are not of a calibre that is fitting to the Sherlock Holmes canon. Now, you will never hear me regularly being a purist about canonicity, but when it comes to Sherlock Holmes, who is known his sole purpose for existing is to be good at making deductions, you have to show him being good at making deductions. Not going, I deduced that this case of knives was bought from a pawn shop because it has a pawn shop's number chalked on it.
Yeah, but it, then if you read, there's a bunch of Sherlock Holmes, you read it and it's like the deductions is that he got his fancy calipers out and he's deduced that it must be someone from like a Javanese island who committed this crime because of the size of the footprints.
I mean, that's not great.
No. Yeah.
Yeah, it's all like this little quote-unquote pygmy scurrying up the walls like a cat and shooting poison darts at people. So I think I think the original stories are very interesting as a testament to their time.
Yeah, and I feel like canonical Puritanism, it sucks. I hate it. I don't like it. And I love anachronism and I love the kind of... The author is dead. Arthur Conan Doyle is literally dead. Like, fucking do what you want with the character in this estate and all of that and like... absolutely go wild. But I do think that in detective fiction, more than anything else, like the voice of the author affects the voice of the character in a really distinctive way. And I think this is why often like Agatha Christie adaptations fall apart a little bit, is that the voices of her main characters are so distinctive. The style in which these books are written is so, so distinctive. Same goes for Sherlock Holmes. I think everyone who tries to imitate Arthur Conan Doyle, for all of his flaws, has this very distinctive way of creating the character. And it means that most people are then like, I'm going to do a Sherlock Holmes thing. And they're just like, well, he's just going to be an absolute dickhead. And I am talking about BBC Sherlock here. But
he's going to be a dickhead that also kind has of like supernatural powers.
I hated that show. I watched it. I hated it. I don't want to talk about it because it's just going to stress me out. But there's this real problem that when you're like, oh, you've got the brilliant detective, you have to have like the charisma of the author to carry you through. And adaptations often fall apart on that. And like, I recently read the sort of continuations of the Dorothy L. Sayers Peter Wimsey mysteries from after she died that sort of take the original material and notes that she was working on and develop them into further books. And they're fine, but they're so much less charismatic than the originals because they don't have her kind of particular... I hate that I'm saying this. I hate that this film has forced me to defend canonical purity. I think especially with like a mystery and a detective character and a kind of like problem-solving character, so much of the way that they solve those problems is reflected in the kind of persona of the character, the voice and the charisma and that sort of thing. And it's really, really hard to imitate that when you are not the person who created this character in the first place.
And within that film, a lot of the things which make Holmes, Holmes, are edited and altered and changed in these really strange ways. Like something that we talked about off recording was how heinous the violin playing is. And the fact that the actor very evidently could not play the violin or would not learn. And they had to reshape the whole part of the story involving the violin to make him really bad at the violin.
They even, like, yeah, had dialogue in which I think it was Mycroft who was like, you've been playing that thing for so many years, why haven't you ever learned? And I was like, what? Why didn't you just, like, make him do the thing and then put a good soundtrack over it? Like, it's really easy to pretend you play the violin.
Perhaps it was just the psychology of the brother coming in again of saying, like, you've been trying at something for so many years, why haven't you succeeded? Why, Sherlock? Why haven't you succeeded? Mother would be furious with you, Sherlock.
Oh my God. Something that I was thinking about in terms of how this kind of like relates to original material is that you do get these sort of like little cameos of Ripperology. You have the new bonnet. In the final scene, Carfax is wearing the top hat and cape. And you have this kind of moment of his silhouette, which is very, very striking. Annie Chapman goes to an abattoir for very unclear reasons. This whole scene was just completely insane. It's just like some very sexy, mostly naked men carting dead pigs around. It's really weird. It's just an opportunity for Barbara Windsor to sort of wiggle her tits at someone and say that, you know, he can have sex with her for free because she's such a slut. But there's also this kind of Easter egg in the scene of the leather apron, right? And the speculation that Jack the Ripper may have been a butcher because of the way that he attacked his victims and all of that sort of stuff, and like particularly the removal of organs and partial organs. And it was so weird to see it turned into this kind of like funny, sexy little joke that these men are wearing leather aprons, they've got these big knives, they're doing this kind of butchery. She says something like, oh, take care you don't slip and hurt yourself with that big knife, and then she gets stabbed moments later. And it's so like, it's the tonal shifting here is completely insane, but beyond that, it's this really weird collision of like two canons.
But I think that is one of the attempts to point the direction of like a potential murderer. So you introduce Leather Apron and then she gets killed, and like she foreshadows her death a little bit by saying, I hope you don't get stabbed by, like, you know, be careful of your knife or whatever. And like it's never really played out any more than that. So it only makes sense if you're aware of the backstory. There's a few times where they talk about sort of deviancy, and there's a really weird scene that where Sherlock Holmes lays out the story about who they should be looking for, and he essentially does this whole profiling thing about the murderer. We're in the morgue / soup kitchen. Dr. Murray's, don't know what the term is to describe it, but severely mentally disabled assistant folds down the sheet on this woman's feet and is just like stroking her feet. And this is like what is happening while Sherlock Holmes is talking. And then Dr. Murray lifts, puts the sheet back. And I think there's that. And then there's another bit where someone talks about how they've seen a woman leaving the scene. And it might be, and Sherlock Holmes says, it might not have been a woman. It might have been a man wearing a woman's clothes, because there is no pattern of behavior in a deranged mind. I think what's happening is that there are these ideas about quote unquote deviant behavior, which is like foot fetishism. And at that time as well, the camera sort of lingers over the assistant that we later find out is the oldest son of this duke. I think we're meant to think, oh, you know, probably he did it. He had access to all this material. He's around here all the time. So he is probably the one to do it. And then, you know, I wonder if there was maybe in the 60s, there are these sort of ideas were much more prevalent than they are now. So that's a much more coherent decoy than it is to our modern eyes, perhaps.
I also read the assistant / we find out Duke's son, Michael. My note was like, why is no one concerned that Dr. Murray's Igor-like assistant is fondling these feet? And I just like really read him intertextually with Igor from film versions of Frankenstein, which I think like makes sense given that often you see Frankenstein, Sherlock, and Jack the Ripper kind of talked about in similar circles. But yeah, throughout it, he really did just act like Igor. And I was like, are we going to find out that actually there's like an electrical thing in the other morgue over there, and they're like reanimating bodies, and the Jack the Ripper's a reanimated body? But yeah, I think that was a really interesting point about like the deviancy, quote unquote, that keeps getting brought up. I also read it a little bit as like transphobia, particularly with the moment when he's talking about the woman's silhouette, or Watson says, I saw a woman in the fog. And he's like, you couldn't have known if it was a woman, though, because it could be a man in woman's clothes who would be doing this killing. And it just really resonated with all of the incredibly stupid discourse over gender neutral bathrooms.
It is so disheartening that the stupidest part of this film is still relevant today.
Yeah.
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 Absolutely. Yeah.
I kind of want to think about this film in its era and the way that, like, I guess it's the mid-60s. It's not quite into the so-called golden age of serial killing yet, but this sort of like 60s, 70s time of fear in particular is really interesting. The ideas of like deception as part of that, and the way that you see this kind of like this creation really of paranoia around like, don't go out alone, don't go out at night, particularly focused on women. You have these sex workers repeatedly saying like, I've lost all my income. No one ever really takes that seriously. But the kind of policing of the spaces that you're allowed to be in and the kind of control and coercion that goes with that, I found interesting. There's also a scene where Dr. Murray is giving a speech where he sort of talks about how actually this has been a good thing for Whitechapel because it's brought all of this media attention. And he talks about this idea of murder by misery, which chimes a lot with the genuine, like, Victorian understanding of sort of Whitechapel as the big villain in the end of the day. But then he loses the crowd by saying, you know, the problem is all of the sex workers and brothels and all of these pubs, and the crowd who have been like, yeah, yeah, rescue us, we deserve better, are suddenly like, oh, but we love our fun. And it's this really interesting bit of, I think, very 60s morality of, like, deserving and undeserving, of sort of salvation and moral guidance and things like that. The fact that in the soup kitchen you have to sing a hymn before you get any of the weird mystery broth. There's an interesting kind of morality to this film. And although there is not as much kind of like anti-sex work in this as there is in some of the other Ripper adaptations and narratives that we've seen, it's very present in a different kind of form of like purity politics.
Yeah, I definitely made a lot of notes during that speech because it was a weird instance where the real Jack the Ripper was crossing into this fictional world, and like the real Whitechapel of the 1880s was like being discussed, but also was in not being discussed because it was a Sherlock film. That's where I really, I think, felt the like tension between the historical and the fictional most. But it really, my first note was, wait, so Jack the Ripper is good? Because that was ultimately the thrust of his speech, was like, these murders have been a really good thing for this community. Now the world's eyes are on us and will take us seriously. But his only solution for these problems seemed to be a sort of radical evangelical Christianity. And I was like, so it's, that's like our only solution to poverty, is this kind of like formulation of a radical Christianity. There's no other solution. And then right after that speech, it immediately cut to like this weird scene with the Prime Minister and the Home Secretary and Mycroft. And later on, you had, I think it was Murray said this quote, but potentially it was Sherlock. It might have been Sherlock, actually, said any government, because Mycroft's like, you have to help us save the government because there's going to be a no confidence vote on the prime minister because of these Jack the Ripper murders. And they say any government that allows the poverty of Whitechapel deserves riddance. And I was like, well, that seems like a like positive, like I would agree with that. You know, governments that consistently cut budgets to essential spending and leave people unable to afford anything, maybe they should go. I don't know, just a
unlike thought. Sherlock Holmes, we do believe in getting involved in politics.
Yes, but I was like, I fundamentally agree with that message of the film, except that that never is not followed through on in any way.
But isn't that just presented because we're supposed to think, because we're given all of these clues about who the murderer is and all of these false like red herrings, and one of them is that it's Dr. Murray, who, and in this scene we're meant to think that, oh right, so he is Jack the Ripper and he is killing people to draw attention to the misery of this place. So like there is like, the reason is that none of this is never resolved is because every single plot point, like nothing serves an external or internal purpose. It's just ways to try to trick you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was fully invested in Murray as the Ripper, and I was really disappointed when it was the other random guy who's very similar to the other random guy.
Yeah, I think that Murray actually had the much better motive for being Jack the Ripper. Like, I would have bought that motive so much more as the reason why women were being killed than, oh, I'm just going to kill prostitutes one by one, hoping I find this one.
Also, like, are we supposed to think that, like, the two sons of this duke are, like, hanging out at the same soup kitchen / morgue quite a lot? And he just like never realizes that it is his brother that he has been looking for, like this entire time. Like, what happened there? That's just never explained.
No, I guess he was just too distracted by Judi Dench.
Yeah, can we talk about Judi Dench for a bit? We haven't actually even mentioned that she was in this film.
It's so funny because when you Google this film, she's like the second name that pops up after John Neville, who plays Sherlock Holmes. And so clearly everyone who's like, she's the person who's had the sort of biggest career from this point. And so everyone's like, oh, it's got Judi Dench in it. And I was like, well, she's got to do something. It took me ages to realize it was even her. And all she does is just like make soup and make people sing. And it's just, I mean, so she's funny.
But this was very early in her career, you have to keep in mind. So I don't think she was Judi Dench yet.
No.
You know, she was just Judi Dench. She was a young actress. She had a 1960s haircut. And she was in this film, like all the other young actresses in this film, some of whom became big somebodies and some of whom less so.
I'm honestly kind of out of things to say about this film because it just like...
Yeah, I think the only like real sort of wrap up of this goes back to what we've been talking about in other Ripper watches is the fact that the Jack the Ripper crimes have become so much a part of popular culture that they no longer seem real. And part of that has to do, I think, as we've talked about before, with like the rise of true crime and sort of the storyification, the narratization of crime, that we've become somewhat desensitized to it and like, you know, reading about it and looking for answers. But there is something, I think, an extra layer with Jack the Ripper that he so often appears alongside canonical fictional characters and alongside all kinds of different fictional narratives. And this one especially, Sherlock Holmes is not real, but Jack the Ripper was, and we're meant to believe that they exist in the same universe. And it's similar. I don't remember if we've mentioned it on the podcast, but I know I've told you all about it. It's similar to my Sherlock Holmes game that I have, which is called the Ripper Murders. There's several. The first one is like the Thames Murders, and then the second one's like the West End Murders. But there's a Jack the Ripper like series where you are an assistant of Sherlock Holmes and Sherlock is busy. So he gives you the case and you have to go out and try to solve the Ripper murders woman by woman. And it's like this weird, because all the other cases in all the other series of this game are fake. And then you have Jack the Ripper who's not. So yeah, I think that there is like that interesting impulse that people keep having to fictionalize these murders.
And it's part of what makes this version of a Ripper story so very weird, is that they have to adjust the parameters of reality to accommodate these fictional characters. So they have to completely write out the character of Fred Aberline and put Inspector Lestrade into that role instead, which completely changes the tone of the police investigation aspect of this, because Lestrade is a comic relief character. He is bumbling, he is weird. He seems very sleepy, even when he's just come across a horrifying murder victim scene. And it just sort of like re-edits real history in a way that alienates the viewer from it and makes it seem like bad fiction. Because so much of the time, real history doesn't make very good fiction. It's not like, real history is messy. It doesn't have neat resolutions. It doesn't have neat plot points. But a Sherlock Holmes story has to have that. It has to have that satisfying wrap-up.
Yeah, I mean, the people that made this wanted to tell a Sherlock Holmes story, but added the Jack the Ripper elements as spicing, as a way to like give an extra like sort of cachet, in a similar way to, you know, Enola Holmes wanted to tell a story about like a plucky heroine who's also very good at solving puzzles and has all these similarities. So we put that into a Sherlock Holmes narrative to explain it and give it more sort of credence. But the difference is that Enola Holmes does it and it's very charming and pleasant, and this does it and you're disregarding and belittling the lives of so many people who suffered really horribly, and you're doing it all for laughs.
I have one tiny thing to add, which is another completely unrelated tangent, but John Neville, who plays Sherlock Holmes in this, was mostly known as a romantic and comedy actor before this. He was like a bit of a movie heartthrob. He is also, speaking of adaptations that completely miss the point of the source material. Briefly, he is Humbert Humbert in the doomed Broadway musical Lolita, My Love, which, if you've listened to Lolita podcast by Jamie Loftus, absolutely terrible. But he plays Humbert Humbert in Lolita, My Love. And when I found that out, I was somewhat overcome with this information. This feels very much like a kind of, 60s grab bag. You've got the costuming, you've got the styling, you've got the kind of like fun musical, you've got the like shocky, gory, splashy stuff. The fact that the American poster refers to Sherlock Holmes as the original Caped Crusader and is basically just a big Batman joke is quite incredible. And just the whole sort of cultural context of this film is very, very strange.
Yeah, the American poster has little speech, like sort of action bubbles that says pow, bang, crunch, biff. And then there is a woman with her like cleavage out in motion, and the bubble next to her says, aye, presumably the sound of someone being murdered.
Oh no.
Making another pitch here for the actually existent Batman x Jack the Ripper crossover Gotham by Gaslight, which we have to read and talk about at some point, because this is not the first time that there has been Jack the Ripper superhero canonicity.
Yeah, if I have one nice thing to say about this, is that John Watson has a really nice smoking jacket that I would quite like.
This concludes another one of our Ripper watches. We will be doing more. If you know of any other material that refers to Jack the Ripper that we might have missed, please send it our way. We are trying to kind of do this series as a way of engaging with the pop culture afterlife of something very grim and violent, and films like this one are a bit of levity. So if you have any more stuff like this that is just anywhere near as unhinged as this film is, we would love to hear it. Thank you so much for listening. We'll be back next week with our episode on Enola Holmes, which comes as a pair with this one, so some of our references will make more sense then. In the meantime, you can see us on Twitter at History Friction and support us on Patreon if you feel like helping us out. See you next week. And until then, big sleigh.